Okay, the next item we had originally scheduled to be next is the open public input. And we're going to do something a little different in that we know that many of you are here to talk about Hoofrot, the Hoofrot problem, and I've consulted with some of your some of the people who are here to talk about that, and we had planned to have the director discuss that during the director's report that follows open public input. In talking with some of the people who are here, they preferred hearing from the director about what the agency's plans are, the progress that we've made to date. So we're going to, but we don't want you to have to sit through the entire director's report on a variety of subjects before you can talk with us. So I'm going to ask the director and the assistant director to address foot rot or hoof rot first. You can hear their report, and then those of you who want to comment will be free to during the open public input that follows immediately after that. So, Director Anderson?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Good morning, everyone. The hoof rot disease issue is a very serious one, primarily impacting our elk populations in the Mount St. Helens herd, but concerns about that spreading to other areas like Willapaw Hills. We have been actively engaged in trying to understand the cause of the disease and look for potential remedies to the disease, and we've been eliciting help from outside experts, and in particular universities, in helping analyze samples that we have taken through our efforts with department staff. And I've asked Assistant Director Nate Pamplin from our wildlife program to come forward here and provide some additional, more detailed information for both the public's knowledge that they may or may not be aware of, as well as the commission. And we'll be anxious to hear from the public during our open public comment period on this issue. So with your permission, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Nate to provide some additional information.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Director Anderson. Hoof disease, well, I'd actually begin with wildlife disease management is probably one of the most challenging aspects of our field in terms of trying to address that mortality factor. Oftentimes with diseases, we don't understand the causes. It's a free-ranging population, multiple vectors that could cause the disease. And so sometimes there's a variety of things that it's gut-wrenching to watch animals suffer through this type of malady. And oftentimes as managers, there isn't much that can be accomplished. But I'd like to walk through some of the things that we do know. We do know that there are 40 possible causes of hoof disease. We don't know what particular cause is what's occurring in Southwest Washington. We're seeing this malady in all age classes of elk. The good news, if there is good news, is we're not seeing it in deer, and we're not seeing it in domestic livestock in the area. And so it seems for whatever reason, this particular vector is just impacting elk, and again, all ranges, all hooves. And then, of course, this condition can lead to secondary and tertiary causes of mortalities as well, because an animal is limping and might not be able to be as mobile, get away from predators. The disease moves up into the other areas and causes other types of infections. So we've been seeing observations of hoof disease in Southwest Washington since the mid-90s. And there have been some reports where we haven't been seeing it as a population-level impact. The amount of observations we're seeing now is causing us some very real concern about the health of this herd and what's causing this particular disease. We conducted a preliminary study in 2009 and had looked at those results. Again, it didn't tell us really what didn't isolate this issue. And so we've been consulting with experts actually from around the world in the field of hoof disease with Washington State University and with our wildlife veterinarian. And we've initiated an additional study this winter where we removed young of the year animals from region 5, where this issue is occurring, in region 6, which has comparable habitat, but it's not in an affected area, and then in region 3, just to try to look at how does this disease get set on with animals. What's very interesting is we're seeing some pretty advanced stages of hoof disease, even in those young of the year animals in region 5. So again, kind of that causing us for real concern. A lot of folks were wanting to, everybody's wanting to understand, okay, what's next? What can we do? And because we don't know the root cause, it's hard to troubleshoot and identify this is the solution for that cause, because there could be so many. We don't know if it's viral. We don't know if it's elk to elk, if it's environmental or toxicological or some sort of micronutrient deficiency or bacterial. A couple options that once we do find out the root cause, just to kind of look into the reading the tea leaves here, we might be in a position to, for instance, remove hoof diseased animals, those animals that are showing signs of that condition. Another option might be is that it requires us to reduce antlerless harvest opportunity to try to compensate for this disease mortality that's occurring. We will The samples have been collected. Folks are analyzing those now and have been sent out to different universities. I don't have the timeline of when the results are. That's just me not knowing the details of the study. But we were looking at providing a more thorough briefing at the June commission meeting. This was a pretty tight window for your April agenda, as well as with the samples just being collected this winter. We talked about it. I was called to the floor in March, as well as Jerry Nelson spoke to it during the elk season setting. Didn't have a lot of new information to bring to you. Hopefully in June we'll be in a better position to talk about the results of those studies. Also in March we heard about, gosh, we really need to get the word out to hunters. And so we've included some language in the hunting pamphlet that speaks to this condition, speaks to you know, everything from handling of meat, et cetera. So trying to help get the word out. We did have a public meeting last fall to try to share and hear concerns from the public. In addition, this has been a topic of legislative interest, and so I have done a number of briefings across the street. I had a meeting with a landowner in the Tootle area with Representatives DeBolt, Wilcox, and Kretz, and talking about this issue and other things that can be done besides for what the department's doing, kind of how can the public be enlisted to help in that partnership. And so I was pretty encouraged by that conversation. So I guess I would conclude that's what we know thus far. We'll do a more thorough briefing in June. Don't want to have this be that just because we don't know doesn't mean that this is something that we're putting on a back burner. This is front and center for us. It's a significant issue, and certainly is front and center for the public's mind as well. When you see these animals in this condition, it's pretty disturbing.
Thank you. Commissioner Jennings was first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you said, you first started noticing this quite a few years ago, but in a relatively small number of animals, so it wasn't a population level impact at that point. And now it seems to be more prevalent. So do we have any idea of the percent of the herd that is infected? Is it a 2%, 5%, 25%?
I don't know, and this is where it would be good for me to have, you know, having the district wildlife biologist from that area. I know that when they went out this winter to conduct the sampling, the number of animals that they were seeing was pretty startling. I mean, pretty awakening to see how many animals are affected.
Thanks.
Commissioner Smith?
Thank you. Nate, are other states facing this issue, or have they faced this issue in the past that we can benefit from their experience?
Certainly on a variety of disease issues, yes, we have. And for instance, we're dealing with a disease issue in the Titan bighorn herd right now. It's a totally different disease, but just in terms of managing wildlife diseases and some of the responses when you have a very virulent strain, we know what the cause is, and we can go in and essentially take a pretty heavy-handed management action we're ending up removing that herd in an effort to try to save adjacent herds that currently don't have it. As far as hoof disease and others, I don't have the expertise to look at what's going on with the other states. This is something that, having the benefit of our veterinarian up in front of you, will be helpful in June.
Right, because I would imagine that from the veterinarian's point of view, they're linked into this on a national or international basis. So.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Nate, a number of these people that testified to us expressed concerns on the health side and that the meat was refused by processors for acceptance. And there seems to be some confusion whether or not there's a health issue with the meat itself. Have we been able to determine that status as yet?
No, we haven't. And we're not in a position to be able to certify the health of any meat that's harvested from wild animal. I mean, that's a role that USDA does for domestic animals. We're not able to offer that with hunters. So in our pamphlet message, we're advising hunters, first, refrain from shooting an animal that appears sick. And secondly, if the animal looked healthy when you harvest it, the meat smells, looks okay, kind of the look and smell tests and all those aspects, we're not aware of this being where it could impact human health, but then you also need to handle it appropriately, do the proper care of the meat in the field. We're just not aware of any issues from the meat being consumed by humans.
Would it be appropriate for us to, I know it's not our job to be health specialists, but can we refer this to someone so we can get that clarified? There's, I think, a number of people that are going to have expectations if they harvest unhealthy animals that we might want to reimburse their permit that they've been waiting to draw or want another tag or whatever, and we need to have the basis for making that decision. Can you help us with that by June?
We'll certainly try to. I've asked Captain Schlenker and Regional Wildlife Program Manager Yonker to specifically look at our internal statewide policy associated with reimbursing or reissuing tags for animals that harvest diseased wildlife. And so we're kind of taking that, and really this was the impetus for that review.
Thank you.
Commissioner Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any evidence of this hoof rot problem transfers to any domestic animals, cattle, goat, sheep, whatever?
We haven't seen that. We're not seeing that in domestic animals in the area. Certainly, of the 40 different types that could cause hoof disease, I'd imagine there are types that can affect all hoofed, all ungulates. But this particular syndrome, where I'm not aware of any instances of domestic animals, and we just don't know how it's caused and how it could be, if it's something that could be contagious.
Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Kaney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Other herds, any even small incidences of the disease or that you know of or we know of?
We'll hear about observations of hoof disease in other areas, but again, it's kind of a pretty minimal background level. It's not the severity of the issue that we're seeing in Southwest Washington. I've heard of instances, for instance, up in Whatcom, Skagit County area, some in the southern end of Region 6. Certainly, we'll see this in other deer or elk herds as well, but it seems pretty isolated. It's not to the level that we're seeing here.
Nate, do we have a portion of our website that describes the syndrome provides information to people who might want to know more?
Yes, we have information on our website on our disease, wildlife disease pages. We have a large section on hoof disease and what we know about it. So the summary report from our 2009 blood serum analyses, as well as we are using a variety of things about where we're asking citizens to report observations. And so we have a new tool, whether it's for reporting of online wolf observations or even tsunami debris. We have one that we've just set up specifically asking for hunters in Southwest Washington to report observations of hoof disease, so we can kind of start seeing where is it occurring and use the benefits of that many other eyes out in the woods paying attention to this and providing us information.
Great. Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nate, perhaps in previous briefings you've mentioned this, but today you mentioned, you reiterated viral. I think in the past we heard bacterial. And maybe I've heard this and I forgot, fungal. Has anybody, that ever come up?
I believe that can be one of the possible issues with hoof disease. I'm not familiar with it. I did got some literature here, and I'll try to get back to you with that one, sir.
Okay.
That's not the beginning. It's the middle. We started talking about this, as you mentioned, a couple months ago. So more to be heard in June. Okay, we need to move on to the rest of the director's report. So we've got a big list of other things.
We'll try to help catch up maybe here a little bit. Deputy Director Storr is going to hit the budget legislative status, as well as an update on our efforts in working with partners on the Yakima Basin Integrated Plan and the Tianaway Lands Acquisition as well, which is an area that both he and I have been spending a lot of time on in recent weeks. Completed, so to speak, our North Falcon process here on Wednesday of this week. We had a number of new staff on our DFW team from the FISH program that performed admirable. They performed really well. We really did have a great team, and with a number of younger folks, at least from through my eyes, that are a part of our team. So it gives me great hope for our future in terms of our staff capacity on working on the developing all of the fishery regimes. This is a pink year, so we're in an odd year with pink salmon, with significant abundances of pink salmon returning to, in particular, to Puget Sound. So we're going to have a wide variety of opportunities for pink salmon. We've also got healthy runs of coho salmon. We've got some abundances of hatchery chinook returning to Puget Sound. And so we're looking to have a number of good fishing opportunities this coming season in Puget Sound. Along the coast, the ocean fisheries have similar chinook and coho quotas to what they did last year, and even though our hatchery abundance of lower, particularly Columbia River coho, is down from the previous year, we've got some other stocks taking their place, so the coho quotas are similar to last year. We also have a bit of a different mix of chinook stocks in the Columbia River. The Spring Creek hatchery, which is just above Bonneville Dam, was quite strong last year, not as strong this year. But we do, again, have a variety of hatchery chinook stocks that contributed to the pot. And we also have a reduction in the allowable catches in Alaska and along the British Columbia coast as a result of the Pacific Salmon Treaty this year, which helped us be able to craft some Chinook fishing seasons in Washington that would have otherwise been more constrained. Our coastal stocks, in particular our coho stocks, are robust. And while we have marked selective fisheries for coho in the ocean fisheries, the freshwater and estuary areas, particularly in Grace Harbor and Willapa, should see good abundances of coho, with providing quite a bit of opportunity both in the marine areas, estuary areas, as well as freshwater areas. The other thing that we did this year that is that we have our Mark's selective fishery for Chinook in Nia Bay, LaPush, Westport, and Columbia River area. We have the same quota on that fishery that we did last year, which is about 8,000. That provides about a two-week opportunity. But one of the things that we did in Nia Bay and LaPush this year is that we put 4 days of that. We took a week from June, took that out, and created 4 days of opportunities that overlap the halibut fishery. And we did that for two reasons. One is we thought that anglers in Nia Bay and LaPush might be able to take more advantage of the opportunity than they were last year. But the other piece is by offering a marked selective Chinook opportunity on Friday. We have our halibut opener on Thursday and Saturday. The marked selective salmon opportunity will be on Friday and Saturday. And so by having that opportunity on Friday, we take some pressure off rockfish. And so I was excited that our constituents up there were also excited about that and recognized that as a potential benefit kind of from two different directions. And so that's a part of the package. So I'll just leave it there. Appreciated Commissioners Mankin and Carpenter being with us along at least the part of the journey, and particularly this last week. As we've talked offline a little bit about some of the changes in the North of Falcon process and some of the challenges that we have in the future. Before I leave it, that topic, let me just also say that we do have three areas which are not complete. One of those is the sport fishery in the Puyallup River. And we had a number of discussions with the Puyallup tribe, of course, over the course of the last 6 weeks, but more specifically in the last 7 days. And the results of those discussions have not concluded. And so we will not have anything in our sport pamphlet as it relates to the sport seasons in the Puyallup River. I say that a little bit tentatively because there's still a couple of days left before it has to go to the printer, and so there may be some progress made that may result in us having something to put in there, but at the moment we don't. Same situation with the Skokomish River. We have not reached a resolution with the Skokomish tribe. They are looking at, as a matter of fact, they have a regulation that they passed by the tribal council that would require a tribal permit in order to fish in the Skokomish River adjacent to the reservation boundary. They suggest in that regulation that they would develop the seasons in consultation with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. So as you can imagine, there's a number of issues there that need to be worked through before we have anything to say about the sport fishery in the Skokomish River in that area. And then lastly, Grace Harbor is another area. We do not have an agreement with the Quinault Indian Nation, although we've had a number of meetings. And we also are looking at putting in a tangle net fishery for the commercial fishery in Grace Harbor. That would be a first. And we are looking at all of the available information and want to make sure that we approach the release mortality rate in a precautionary way. And so we will be having another public meeting on that topic, among others, with our Grace Harbor advisors on Monday night of this week. And so that's still, that piece is still in play. And we'll be working that with those folks. So those are, I'll leave North Falcon and just move on to a quick update on our in-season adjustments that we used. The Pacific Fishery Management Council, of course, met over from Friday through yesterday. And we proposed to the council as an in-season management action that they modify as an in-season adjustment the recreational regulations in our area 3 and 4 to mirror the action that the commission took relative to cabazon, the minimum size limit, the bag limit, and the minimum size limit for lingcod. And so that was, we were successful in getting that done on I think Tuesday, and so that we'll have we'll have complementary federal regulations to the state regulations as a result of the commission action on that topic. I think many of you know that the culvert case decision came out, and it largely upheld the position of the tribes. And there, as a result, I've got this map, and I can pass it around. But there's 807. All these green dots are blockages that need to be corrected over a course of a period of time. These are DOT blockages. There's 817 of them. There's also a requirement that the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Department of Natural Resources correct its our blockages by 2016, and we are on track to complete that work. Matter of fact, we're ahead of schedule. It will take much longer to correct the 817 and cost something in close to $2 billion is the estimate to get at the fixes that are needed. There, decision, there is a strong reference to our standards being used in terms of how those barriers are corrected, and we are engaged in discussions with the Department of Transportation so we can, and I believe that at the end of the day we will have a substantial role in working with the Department of Transportation and helping them design and corrective measures for their barriers. Let me just quickly talk a little bit about the Skagit steelhead issue. Some of you are aware that there are some individuals, groups that are advocating a catch and release of wild steelhead in the February through April timeframe. We currently do allow it from June through mid-February, but after that point in time, we don't allow it because this species is listed under the Endangered Species Act. It has been below its escapement goal for a number of years. The 2003 through 2012 average escapement was 5,400 fish. The escapement goal is 6,000. That compares to an earlier time frame, 83 through 92, of 9,300 fish. And if you if you look graphically at the decline of the of that population over time, you can clearly see how it's changed. Now, we are estimating, or but last year we did have an escapement of 6,000, almost 6,200 fish, so we made the escapement goal, but it, if we were to, and if we were to allow a catch and release fishery during the mid-February through May timeframe, NOAA Fisheries has told us that it would consider it a directed fishery, and that, so it would not be incidental to targeting on healthy stocks. And for that reason, we would have to qualify for a new permit under Section 10 or under the 4D rule. That would take probably 3 years to do. And so we are not supportive of a catch and release fishery on wild Chinook of a listed species during that time frame, and just wanted you to be aware of the reasons why.
I heard you say wild Chinook.
I meant wild steelhead, sorry.
Okay.
Thanks. Just a couple of pieces on legislation. The license revocation bill, it's a non-controversial piece of legislation, is moving through the process. It's in rules, like with many non-controversial legislation. Sometimes it's harder to get those passed than it is the ones that are controversy around them, because it's hard to get legislators to be champions of them. So we're working hard to try to get it broke out of rules and get it on the House floor. Hunter education, in Governor Gregoire's budget and Governor Inslee's budget and in the House budget, they're all three of those budgets assume that the bill will pass with a $20 fee. The Senate, when they passed the bill, took the $20 fee out. So we're hoping that in conference, the fee will come out as a piece of the legislation, but don't know that yet. And then the other piece was the minimum age of 8 years old to be able to enroll in it was in the Senate, but not in the House. Is that right, Bruce? Yeah. And so, again, we're hoping that in conference that will get reconciled and that will stick. We've spent the majority of our time working on legislation associated with wolf management. And really, there's been a policy piece to that, and there's been a budget piece to that. And it's hard to do, if not impossible, to do one without the other. And that's the delicate balance in negotiating between very strongly held views within different members of the legislature on those two pieces, and have a bill come out that represents a balance or compromise of those competing concerns. No resolution to that yet. Still in play, because at least in some cases, the bills that are necessary to implement the budget live on past cutoff dates. It's a work in progress, and I think I'll just leave it at that, that it's a work in progress. Last, just briefly, also, you're aware that we have a new pack of wolves in the Wenatchee pack. We've also brought on staff so that we now have four trapping teams for the spring trapping season. And so we've got those fully staffed up, and those folks will be out. Well, some of them are already out on the ground, and the rest of the teams are going to be out on the ground here in the coming weeks. So that's my report for this morning, Madam Chair and Commissioners. Happy to answer any questions, and if not, we'll let Deputy Director Storr move on.
Okay. Commissioner Carpenter first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was told several weeks ago that there's a group of people coming down from the Occupy Skagit group tomorrow. And one of the things that I've sensed prior to being on the commission as a stakeholder, I've seen many, many times where constituents would be engaged and trying to promote an agenda item, a view of how things should be managed. And in the fish prong, I'm going to take it under advice. And these people would continue through a series of meetings, hope that their item would stick. And in fairness to them, often the fish program knew for a variety of reasons, biologically, ESA, and otherwise, that it can't stick. And I'm respectful of the department's responsibility to do that without question. But if we know that we can't allow a catch-and-release steelhead fishery, I feel an obligation to call those people, have the staff call those people and tell them that, not have them travel down here tomorrow and back when it's not doable. I just don't think that's a responsible way to handle it.
Director Anderson?
Thanks. Commissioner Carpenter, I know Jim Scott's sitting back there and listening to that. I did talk with Craig Burley earlier this morning. We'll convey that to Craig and see if there's contacts that can be made to help alleviate an individual from having to make a trip down here to testify to an issue that and advocate for a position that we're not able to deliver on.
Thank you, Mr. Director. I think that there's a group of people. That's I've been told, so that's why I'm more concerned than just one individual.
Well, fair enough.
Try to get the word out. And if they choose to come and comment, they are very free and welcome to do that, too. Commissioner Perry.
Yeah, just one question. You talked about the culvert case and what's involved in that. If those culverts should be fixed, just in general, what kind of an impact do you think that will have on salmon and steelhead in Washington? Not any particular river, but just in general.
I think it'll have a very positive impact. It's going to open up areas, spawning areas that currently are blocked, and will should increase the productivity of both salmon and steelhead where that occurs and where there's available habitat above those barriers. And I think the additional challenge we'll have is, as we look at that, what kind of changes do we need to make in our current harvest rates if we need additional fish to reach the spawning grounds to utilize new areas?
Thank you.
Commissioner Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I hear the director's report and the testimony we heard earlier, you know, it constantly reminds me the breadth of responsibilities associated with making the department work properly, from infrastructure challenges that are unpredicted when they start, you know, erupting or growing, to disease outbreaks that are difficult to understand and manage, to just the day-to-day operations of maintaining a good workforce and working with the legislature and making sure we stay within our budget obligations. So that was just a general comment to say, it's always impressive to look at how well this department is run when one recognizes the challenges in the environment that this department has to work with. I wanted to compliment you or your staff or whoever came up with the idea then making it happen to align the Chinook fishery with the halibut. I think that's a great way to approach the challenge that I've had with that sort of down day in the middle, so thank you very much for that. It was really nice to hear that you worked with the federal partners to align minimum link size for cabazon and daily limit. That's excellent. When we had our conference call after the Moses Lake meeting and we addressed those four sports fishing regulation questions, we also asked the department to be able to talk to us about or align it for us to have a follow-up discussion on cabazon season length. And I was thinking we were going to do that in the now to the early June timeframe, is my recollection. So I was just wondering where we were in that process. Yeah, I was thinking that we were talking about having to put it up, open up a supplemental 101, have one level of public comment and engagement for us to revisit that. I'm just looking at the process we did because we voted on it, and then because of the perceived threat of a administrative challenge, we pulled part of that back. We still got the challenge. Right now, I would assume that the pamphlet will say that the season is what it was last year. But I just don't want to drop the process that we asked for, which was coming back and looking at that question, so we do the supplemental 101 properly, or the 101-102 process to address that question.
Director Anderson?
Thanks, Commissioner Jennings. Well, I'd be making something up if I tried to answer your last question right now. So let me check, and I will get back with you. And on your first point of whose idea was it? It was the constituents from Nia Bay.
Great. Thank you.
And they came up with it because Nia Bay and LaPush, when we've had those marked selective fisheries in June, nobody showed up. And so they thought, well, what if we put some of those days somewhere around our halibut fishery? And I said, well, how about making sure that one of those is on the Friday between the Thursday and Saturday opening? They were good with that. And so
that's
I think it,
nice
that should
problem.
Help. Yeah.
Very good. Commissioner Mankin.
As long as we're in the kudu department, as Commissioner Carpenter mentioned earlier, the two of us had the opportunity to attend the North of Falcon meetings, and there was a very different flavor to the meetings this year and some extremely difficult negotiations that had to take place, and I'm always impressed with Phil's ability to deal with very, very hard questions and come up with good answers. And not to slight him at all, he has very, very good staff support, especially with Pat Petillo and his group. And I'm always amazed at how much the co-managers rely on our staff for things like modeling and how they anticipate questions as the dialogue goes back and forth between the co-managers. So I continue to be impressed, and I'm very, very happy to be on your side.
Well, if I could just one quick, I say new just because they look so much younger than me, but I was commenting, I think, to Commissioner Mankin that there was this one thing I said, I wonder how many Puyallup fish are caught in some, where they are. And I don't think it was, I didn't ask anybody to do anything. Somebody overheard me ask the question. And in less than 10 minutes, here comes this model run. I heard you asking about this. Here it is. And it just, I mean, they just performed super. So. Thank you.
Yep.
Appreciate Commissioner Janney's remarks as well.
Give all of our appreciation to North Falcon team. They work extremely hard. So thanks. Okay, Deputy Director Storr, you have more reporting?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a little bit more. I want to touch on two topics briefly to complete the introduction of the various budgets, operating budgets that we're dealing with, and then to talk about the Yakima Basin Integrated Plan, and in particular the Tianaway acquisition, and there could be a decision involved in that discussion. So the House budget came out last Wednesday, and I had briefed the Commission a week ago on the Senate budget. House budget was very similar to both Governor Gregoire's and Governor Inslee's budget, and would not reduce staff levels or programmatic work in any way, which is a very positive thing. It actually takes our budget from the current $362 million for a biennium up to $375 million. Now, most of that increase had to do with what I'll call cost of living increases that we had requested. We got funding for fuel rate adjustments, lease rate increases, fish food, technology, a number of places where we are anticipating new and increased costs. So that was very helpful. Staff salaries, you remember that staff took a 3% reduction at the beginning of this biennium. In all three budgets now, the House, the Senate, and the governor's, those reductions are replaced. So that's good news for our workforce. Facility moves. We received funding to move our Vancouver office from the downtown Vancouver Grand Avenue location to some to-be-determined location. That'll be a co-location with Ecology and potentially with a federal agency. But we got support for that, which will hopefully provide better access and, frankly, better safety for our staff. We did not get funding for move of staff from one of our three downtown Olympia properties. If you remember, we were asked several years ago to sell the three parcels we had in downtown Olympia, and we have moved two of those. We're about to close with the port and the lot, the sewage treatment facility on two of those parcels. April 18th is the closure date. But the third, where we have our staff from the CAMP program, the Capital Assets Program, located on 600 Capital Way, we had to move those people somewhere. And that cost money. And so when we requested the funding in all three budgets, that was not granted to us. So it may be we only sell two of those three properties and we get the legislature to pull back on earlier direction. Fund shifts have played a major part of the strategy that the House and the governor used. About $7.5 million of general fund capacity was reduced and then replaced with other fund sources. A big example of that is in our hatchery work, the fund shift from general fund to the aquatic lands enhancement account. Went from $3.3 million up another $1.1 million, so $4.4 million of dollars of general fund for hatchery management and operations was replaced with ALEA. And that has occurred in a number of other places. And like in some of the other budgets, we got funding for some of our wolf or wildlife-related issues, potentially for some of our wolf-related issues, et cetera. So now that all three budgets are out there, we sort of have the playing field identified, and it looks like the worst case is probably in the Senate budget, where we would, via two non-specified cuts, have to absorb about $3.3 million in reductions. And as I said, the House and the governor's budget are I won't say impact neutral, but they're staffing and activity neutral. So we'll see how that rolls out. I'll move to the Tianaway acquisition.
Before you do that, could you give us a little insights? What do you expect in relation to the culvert costs, which are so new and additional?
We were asked right after the final decision came out what the impact might be to us, and as the director reported, we're on schedule to take care of our own on our lands and have the funding to do so by the 2016 date. The fact that there's a heavy dependence reference to our guidelines and the technical assistance, we made a guesstimate of around $3 million of impacts in terms of if that work was to be funded. And that's kind of a active live discussion that's going on right now. They're gathering up data and trying to figure out ways to cover those costs.
Thanks.
Any other questions about budget? If not, I'll move on to the Tianaway acquisition. I think we briefed the commission, or others have, several times about this project. The Yakima Basin Integrated Plan is a 20-year, $4 billion plan that would allow folks in the Yakima Valley from the upper Kittitas all the way down to the Columbia River, deal with issues around water supply for irrigators and cities, fish passage, habitat preservation via land acquisition. And you had these parties that had been arguing and competing with each other for water for years come together and generate this plan. So that was all well and good, and that happened over the course of the last year. And then in December, part of the land acquisition piece of this plan, the Tianaway, came up for sale. People had been pursuing land that had been previously held by Boise Cascade for probably 15 years. And Boise Cascade sold it to individual from New York, and negotiations had been going on for the last 4 or 5 years with that individual over acquiring that land. Originally, the price on it was somewhere between $200 and $300 million for 50,000 acres. As of December, there was a price that was settled around $97 million. So, you know, down from about $230, $240 originally, down to just under $100 million. That then made it put it on an accelerated path as part of the plan. The notion originally in the plan was to advance each of those issues, the water supply, fish passage, habitat protection, sort of equally, so everybody had a stake in the game. But with the land becoming available, it pushed the Tianaway to the top of the list of things to consider. And what we've seen now with the capital budgets being released is two different financing options. In the Senate budget, the notion is to purchase it outright. So in the Senate budget, there's $132 million for the Yakima Basin plan of general obligation bonds. About 100 of that would go towards the Tianaway purchase. And the Senate has that land going to the Department of Natural Resources, not to us. In the House budget, there's a, I guess you could call it a more modest, it's still $45 million, as in Governor Inslee's budget. About 10 and a half of that $45 million would go towards the Tianaway, and the House budget anticipates going back biennia by biennia to get another appropriation for the complete purchase. And the House budget has that land coming to Fish and Wildlife. So we have been in discussions pretty actively. There's at least one meeting a day on the Tianaway going on right now, around a compromise, and we are very close to coming to agreement with DNR and with the partners in the community there. In fact, a number of the conservation groups are sitting at the table as we write language into the deed. So the deed of purchase would contain the principles that are agreed to in the integrated plan. There would be a DNR would hold title to the land, and our agency would hold a conservation easement, and that conservation easement would guarantee equal decision making, equal partnering, and have detail that the community helps write around habitat protection, and you know, the use of those lands. And then finally, there would be a management plan that we would co-write with the different entities in the plan, and that would detail the day-to-day sort of decision making and management. So the challenge is, with all of this momentum and this thing coming on as quickly as it has been, how do we respect and integrate the commission's role in approving this, given the tidal wave we're standing in front of energy and all the discussions that are taking place. And it's felt a little awkward at times, to be honest with you, as we sit at the table and say, you know, this looks like this might work or it might not work, and not be able to have a connection on a day-to-day basis. So I'm interested, and I proposed in the document that I sent you last Friday, I have a copy here if you need it still, that we might delegate the authority to either acquire or enter into these agreements with other entities like DNR to the director. So we can, you know, have your confidence that you're getting what you need and have the ability to be agile as we kind of move through the session here.
Well, I think one of the questions about how we entertain this idea of delegation is one for our AG about whether this is the type of decision we have to notify the public about ahead of time before we may input on our agenda as an explicit decision, so we can consult with him over the break. Because if it is not that sort of a decision, maybe we can just dispose of it before we adjourn the meeting on Saturday. Okay, any other questions? Director Anderson?
Just on a different topic, one quick note. We, on the Cabazon issue, we've filed the CR-102, and so we would plan to have the commission have a hearing on the 102 at the June meeting.
June meeting, okay. Okay, thank you very much. We are behind schedule, but I think we'll be able to catch up with a bit shorter lunch period. But let's take a 10-minute break. Come back at 10:20. Thanks.